This is lecture number 4 for Ancient Israel, Archaeology Problems. In the last few lectures, we've been taking a look at archaeology as far as its methods are concerned, familiarizing ourselves with the degree to which it's scientific, and also seeing the element of art, especially in the area of interpretation where many things are quite subjective. Today we want to turn our attention to the major problems that archaeologists have to deal with that create of archaeology a science with largely tentative conclusions. The end result of these problems, as I said, is that archaeology is a science that has largely tentative conclusions. First of all, I think I've already mentioned this before, archaeologists must always deal with limited amounts of evidence. Limited amounts of evidence. That only approximately 1/1000th of all the potential evidence from antiquity has survived to the current day. Only 1/1000th of the potential evidence from antiquity has survived to the current day. Now, you may remember the procedural definition that I gave you. It dealt with the systematic recovery of the surviving remains. You see, that's the problem. We're always wondering, the things that have survived, are they truly representative of the whole? Or are they giving us a skewed impression of what an ancient civilization was like? For example, in the article that Paul Lapp wrote, in another journal, this one a professional journal, The Biblical Archaeologist, in 1963, it was entitled Palestine, Known but Mostly Unknown. He wrote that Palestine, meaning the West Bank of the Jordan and Israel today, is perhaps the most excavated land in the world. But at the same time, in 1963, and although this is 1987, I think you could still say that this conclusion of his holds true, is that such a tiny fraction of the archaeological material has been excavated, and such a small fraction of that satisfactorily published. Indeed, after, let me think now, from 1968, 1976, that's 8 years of excavation almost year-round at the Temple Mount, there is yet to be a definitive report published on those excavations. What has come out to date have been a few minor small pieces and a work for the general public, but nothing for the scholar. The vast amount of the information from that Temple Mount excavation under Dr. Mazar has yet to be published and may never be published because he is so in such precarious health. A number of people are working with him as assistants, helping him to try to organize the material and get it published. But there is a very real fear in Israel that he may die before it's published and then nothing will be published because most of the records are in his hands and are interpretable only by him due to not following a particularly standard method of recording of data. And if that happens, that means all the evidence will be gone forever because practically nothing was left for the future to dig. Remember, I mentioned in terms of method that one reason they don't dig a whole site is not just because of lack of money and time, but also because they hope that somebody may come along in the future with better methods and dig the site and maybe correct any errors they inadvertently have made. Well, all that evidence may be lost. It is possible. But going back to Lapp's comment, he says, such a tiny fraction of the archaeological material has been excavated, and such a small fraction of that satisfactorily published, that even the most assured archaeological conclusions, that's pretty strong language, even the most assured archaeological conclusions must still be considered far from final. In other words, there's an element of doubt even in the most assured conclusions. Now, it doesn't mean that all of their evidence is vague. I mean, there are some things that approach the indubitable, but the vast majority of even the most assured conclusions are not yet final, though they might be 90% so. He writes further that in view of the vast amount of unknown material, archaeologists will be forced to modify or reformulate many, if not all, their hypotheses regarding the development of Palestine as the flood of new evidence continues to grow. Palestinian archaeology may be past infancy, but it has hardly gotten beyond childhood. And I think that helps us to put it in its proper perspective. When we talk about biblical archaeology or Palestinian archaeology, we're dealing with a field of study that even as recently as 1963 was described as being just in its childhood. I'll give you an example of how sometimes this has come to pass, where he said that because of the vast amount of unknown material, archaeologists would be forced to modify or reformulate many, if not all, of their hypotheses. There had been the opinion that most of the cities of the late Bronze Age in Canaan were heavily fortified, and they interpreted the conquest of the pharaoh Thutmose III of Egypt as being involved in the reduction and conquest of heavily fortified, heavily walled cities, most notably Megiddo. And a recent study made by Rivka Gonin of the University of Beersheba, in Beersheba, has shown that almost none of the cities of Canaan in the late Bronze Age were fortified, including Megiddo. There was no wall around Megiddo when Thutmose III besieged it. And this has been a revolution in understanding of warfare in that period. Even though he subjected the city to a three-month siege, there was no wall. There were other reasons why he subjected it to a three-month siege rather than the fact that there was a wall there. And so, as I say, a lot of things are changing, especially in the area of the conquest. And the information I will present later about the Israelite conquest is, at the moment, this is what is going on. This is what is believed. A lot of old, long-held beliefs among modern critical scholars have been thrown out completely to the winds. Some new things are in, some of them extremely faddish, I think, and will not stand the test of time, but some that are even more difficult in opposing the truth. He gives a statistic effective in 1963 in this article that scientific excavations, including small soundings and clearances, have taken place at some 150 sites. And of these, the Westminster Atlas records major excavations at 26 sites, the Oxford Atlas at 15. This means that roughly one site in 200 has been the scene of major archaeological work. Now, to be sure, many of the sites on record would not merit extensive excavation. They're not important enough. But if only one in four were promising, major excavations have till now been carried out at only 2% of the potential sites. And therefore, all the conclusions about what Palestine was like and how it evolved were based on excavations at 2% of the sites. Not exactly a very thorough sample, you might say, even though among those 2% were some of the larger places. But getting back to the problems involved in excavation and the fact that because so little is uncovered, you have the difficulties of interpretation. He gives a specific example. He says, let's pretend that you were an archaeologist specifically interested in what cult practices, in other words, religious worship, what religious worship was like in the early Bronze Age. Let's say that was your thing. That was what you were trying to really understand, completely understand and reconstruct. Cult practices or worship in the early Bronze Age. It says you might wish to put the names of sites at which early bronze sherds, you know, pot sherds, have been found in a hat and select three at random. Chances are good that one of the sites is covered with masses of Byzantine and Roman debris. And therefore, you wouldn't want to dig there, because since there are masses of Roman and Byzantine debris, and you're interested in early bronze, which is at the bottom, you'd have to dig through all of this stuff and everything else in between to get to it. It'd be too time-consuming, too expensive. So you say, I'll pass on that site. That's not a very promising one for my labors. Another is the site of a modern village. Well, you can't dig there. You can't make the people move out, so you can dig under their homes. And the third is located where there is not an adequate supply of either water or labor. But in any case, let's say you had studied every early bronze tell with care, and you were thoroughly acquainted with all the pertinent material excavated to date, and had come to the conclusion that you had picked out precisely one specific mound as the most promising in Palestine for recovering early bronze cult material. Most experienced Palestinian archaeologists would probably offer generous odds against your finding what you're looking for. Why? Because maybe what you're seeking will remain hidden a few feet from your excavation. Because you can't dig the whole tell. You have to make some scattered, searches here and there on the site. It's interesting that when Catherine Kenyon was digging in Jerusalem in the city of David, she was looking for the wall around the city wall that David had faced when he conquered the place. She dug a trench 22 meters long. That was what she chose to dig. A little unconventional, some would have chosen 20. She found the wall, but where? In the last half meter of her trench. What if she hadn't made it 22 meters? What if she hadn't made it 20? She never would have found the wall. You see, this is very likely to happen in an excavation. So that's why he says, perhaps what you're seeking for will remain hidden a few feet from your excavation. Or perhaps there were cult remains there. Magnificent ones, extensive ones. But they were completely removed in later occupation of the site, which has happened more than once. Totally razed and removed. All the evidence gone. We have an illustration again in Jerusalem. Josephus records that right close to the southwest corner of the Temple Mount, there was a beautiful chariot race course, a hippodrome, made of very fine marble. The excavation at the Temple Mount didn't find one piece of that hippodrome. It had all been completely removed. Now, if we had no written evidence that it had ever been there, we never would have suspected that it was there, because there's not a clue to its having been there. So these things do happen. You see the problems a man faces? Even when he picks out what's the most promising place, it could remain hidden just a few feet from where he's digging. Or the thing might have been there and then completely razed and removed in later history. Or maybe on this particular tell, they didn't have a special cult area. It was different than most. And unfortunately, you picked the one that was different. And so there is nothing to find at all, and never has been. But let's say against all odds, you discover clear cultic remains. Have you struck pay dirt? Can you now write about what cultic practices were like during the early Bronze Age? No. Because how do you know that this is a typical cult center, rather than, as it says here, a unique pilgrimage center, or the seat of a wizard with his own ideas? You don't know, you see. That's why you might say the cards are stacked so heavily against the archaeologist. Area number two. You've just finished talking about the matter of limited evidence, the difficulty of actually finding it. Let's talk about area number two. There are many complications that are presented by the evidence itself. Many complications presented by the evidence. First of all, as we see in the first slide, this is an idealized version of a tell. Every layer in the mound stretches fully across the tell. Each one is fairly wide. Every level of occupation is present. But this is never found. I think I've referred to this before. Tells are not arranged like seven-layer cakes. More typically, a layer of occupation may cover only part of the tell, as in this second slide. Now, if you dug your trench or your 5-meter square at the position of the right-handed, the dotted line on the right, you would find indication of inhabitation of the site during this period. But let's say you didn't dig here. Let's say you only dug your 5-meter square or your trench where the dotted line is on the left of the slide. You'll notice you would never intersect layer 2A. You would go down from layer 1, to layer 2, you would skip 2A, you would only go to 3. And therefore, your very assured conclusion would be this place was uninhabited during period 2A. Nobody was here. It was empty. And yet you'd be totally wrong, just because you didn't happen to dig in the right place. So this is one of the problems presented by the evidence, is that tells are not arranged like seven-layer cakes. The layers are not evenly distributed across the tell, and therefore you can miss layers of occupation. You can miss layers of occupation. Another problem of the evidence. The original material may have decomposed. The original material may have decomposed. All that may be left may be a cast. What you're looking at here is not actual artifactual remains in this slide. It's the remains of a Viking longboat, but all it is earth. You have a cast in the earth of what the actual remains were like. Now, if digging had proceeded here too swiftly, most of this could have been completely dug up and destroyed before they noticed even what they had. And this sometimes happens. Material things, especially made out of wood and leather, decompose in the soil. It's just gone. Sometimes the fact that something has decomposed is betrayed by the presence of holes in a particular layer. For instance, in digging up Ur in southern Mesopotamia, Selenid Woolley had come to a certain floor level. And he noticed, or rather one of his workers noticed, that there existed, if this is a side diagram, two holes, two very regularly shaped holes in the floor. It was a tightly compacted floor surface, very smooth and hard. And in this smooth, hard floor surface were two perfectly round holes spaced a short distance apart. And fortunately, the supervisor in the area said, "No, wait a minute. That's too round to be accidental." And he poked down in it, and it was just empty space. And he said, "That's not usual either. I just have empty space." And he stopped and he thought, and he says, "You know what? There must have been an object here, probably of wood, that was buried there. And it thoroughly decomposed, and it just left the empty space. What we have, in essence, under the ground is a mold. The empty space is like a mold in the shape of the object which has decomposed. If we pour some plaster of Paris in there, fill up the empty spaces, let it harden, then we can take away the earth and we will have a cast of what had originally been in this hole, and we'll know what kind of an object it was." And as a result of this care, they were able to pour the plaster of Paris in. Today they don't use plaster of Paris. They use a very quick drying acrylic type of plastic. That it made a perfect cast of what had been an ancient lyre, an ancient harp. Now, they would have missed that if they hadn't noticed these two very nice round holes and just continued to chop through the earth. They would have destroyed that mold that had been preserved in the soil, and then that would have been gone forever. And so, again, this is a complication, is that material things frequently decompose in the soil. A third problem dealing with material evidence is that archaeologists do not all use the same methods of either excavation or for the recording of their finds. Again, using the example of the Temple Mount dig under Professor Mazar, it is still a matter of great controversy, the fact that bulldozers were used very heavily on that site. Now, when you bring in a bulldozer, you remove an awful lot at one go. Now, Dr. Mazar was certain there was no importance in that material that was being removed. But a lot of archaeologists quail at the thought of what might have been lost because of that method. And also, as I've already referred to, the fact that the finds were recorded in a very unusual fashion has made it impossible for other archaeologists to read the data and understand what it means. He's the only one that understands the data. That's very risky. And so this is a problem in the area of material evidence, is that archaeologists do not always use the same methods. nor do they use the same methods of recording. Now, fortunately, most archaeologists are kept reasonably in check by the peer pressure of their colleagues. You see, their methods can't vary too much. Dr. Mazar was so distinguished that he probably was the only one in Israel who would have dared to use such methods, not fearing the peer pressure of his colleagues. In fact, the peer pressure was severely muted because of his distinction. It was sort of muttered about in conferences, sotto voce, you know, under the breath, but not really said out loud, simply because of his great prestige. Another problem is that you might find a structure, and it might be made of, let's say, stones that were quite obviously cut during the Israelite period, from Solomon to, let's say, the conquest of Judah by Nebuchadnezzar. There's a particular style that was used during this long period for stone cutting. But what if those stones, because they were so nice, were reused centuries later? You see, you've got to be careful. Just because you find stones that have all the characteristic of the Israelite period, the kingdom period of Israel and Judah, doesn't mean the building dates from that period. The stones might have been taken from an earlier structure and reused in a later one. You've got to be very careful with things like that. Very, very careful. Stones do tend to be reused. I'm mindful of the fact that in the Dome of the Rock, a very beautiful building there on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, that on the inside you have all these beautiful Corinthian-style columns that surround the actual area where the rock is. Now, if one was careless, one would say, oh, the Muslim architects did a beautiful job here. They had these beautiful columns made. No. They just took them out of the various Byzantine churches in Jerusalem and put them in the Dome of the Rock. See? Every Byzantine church in Jerusalem had been destroyed by the Persians in 614, just about 20 years or so before the Muslim Arabs came in. And so there were a lot of ruins of churches with columns in them, and so they said, these are nice columns, they're in pretty good shape, let's bring them over to what we want to build. You see, completely reused. Some of those columns being several hundred years old. Let's come to the third area where difficulties present themselves. And this is again dealing with the dating of periods arrived at through the use of pottery. I've already talked about the fact that it's an assumption that the same pottery is in use everywhere in the region at the same time. And that in one specific instance, the matter of Lachish, level 3, it's been shown that that assumption was not correct. Though, as the archaeologist would say, better to use something that you know has problems than not to have anything to use at all. And so they use it even though they know the assumptions make what they're doing somewhat weak. But there are a lot of problems in the way pottery has been used to arrive at the dates for given periods. I attended a conference of the American School of Oriental Research in Chicago a few years ago, and a man gave a paper that created a tremendous stir. As a matter of fact, when he got to the punchline, if you can use that expression, of his paper, there was a very audible gasp that came out of the audience, wrenched, if you will, from their throats. Because what he had done was to show that there's a certain kind of pottery, if you want the technical term, I'll throw it out, it's really not that important, Mycenaean 3B, certain kind of pottery. And everybody, whenever they find that kind of pottery in their dig, they say, oh, this is easy. This level where this pottery is must be dated to this date. And they just write it down as a given. They don't even bother to think about it. Because everybody knows the dates for Mycenaean 3B pottery. Well, in his paper, he went back, he said, because he was curious, to see how the man who had first decided what the dates should be for this kind of pottery, how he had arrived at his conclusion. And what he showed us conclusively in his presentation is that the man who gave the archaeological world these dates had done a particularly shoddy bit of work. Not one piece of pottery that he used in arriving at his conclusions had been found in a clearly dated context or a clear stratigraphic context. It was one of the worst pieces of scholarship that has ever been seen. And yet, because people didn't know how he had arrived at it, had trusted the man because of his reputation that he would do a first-class job, and he had presented his argument so convincingly, everybody had just accepted the dates and that was it. And so he asked at the end of the paper, what do we do now when we find Mycenaean 3B pottery? Do we pretend we don't know and just assign the dates we've always used? There was a nervous titter in the audience, because that's what probably most people would choose to do rather than end up with something you can't use at all. Just pretend you never knew anything about it and just go right merrily on your way. Or, he said, should we suspend judgment until we do find this pottery in a clearly datable context or a clear stratigraphic context and we can arrive at the true dates? But anyway, as I said, the paper caused no small stir, because this type of pottery is used very widely for dating levels in Greece and Cyprus and much of the northwest Semitic part of Asia, Phoenicia, Syria, and Palestine. So as I say, here's one particularly bad case. Now, your article on the importance of dating by Paul Lapp also notes something else that has operated in this area, which we must be very careful about. It's on page, well, the way the pages are enumerated, because they're taken out of the article itself, page number 15 on the left-hand side, in about the middle of the page, you have a long paragraph. It says, a fourth obstacle to systematic development of chronological precision was the neglect of detailed critical pottery studies. And a few lines down, it says, often, and this is the point that sort of is the generalization behind this specific example I just gave you, often no distinction was made between dates proposed for unstratified examples and for specimens from a context with good links to absolute chronology. In other words, no distinction was made when one study presented dates that were based on careful correlations with absolute chronology and those studies that were made from unstratified samples, like the example of Mycenaean 3B pottery I just gave you. The chorus of uncritical datings had the unfortunate result of gaining for the datings an undeserved confidence. If a dozen archaeologists cite a similar date for a certain form, it must be correct. Unfortunately, in many cases, the dozen archaeologists were all merely repeating what was originally an uncritical oral tradition. In other words, they're all mirroring, mimicking, I should say, a mistake that there was something that was a mistake to start with. Instead of each one carefully re-examining it from scratch with no preconceived ideas, they simply present a study which seems to confirm the dating because they just trusted it anyway and expected it to be correct. They don't do really a careful study on their own. And then after enough people have done it, then nobody questions it anymore. It's like the old saying, a person puts down on a resume, he has 10 years of experience in the field. And a skillful interviewer will try to find out, does he have 10 years of experience in the field, or does he have 1 year of experience repeated 10 times? There's a big difference. It's the same thing in this area. Do we have 10 critical, detailed, careful studies all validating the same date, or do we have 10 studies carelessly validating a date that was a mistake in the first place? Let's consider the question as to what happens once a date has been established for a certain type of pottery and it's been done in error, and then later evidence indicates a different date. how readily is this new evidence accepted? We have here on page 14, the bottom paragraph, Lapp writes, another difficulty was the fact that from the start, Palestinian excavators tied their finds to the epochs and events of Near Eastern history and archaeology. Once such relationships were made, it became difficult to gain general assent for new proposals, even when they were based on much stronger evidence. Do you get the full import of that? Somebody has made a linkage between a certain type of pottery in Palestine and a certain type in Egypt, and thereby given a date to this layer in Palestine. Later evidence shows quite conclusively that is wrong, and still the opinions don't change. They're practically set in concrete. People tend to ignore it. Once a general assent has been achieved for a certain dating, even new evidence makes it very difficult to move the opinion. This is part of the problem of archaeological procedure, is that these things become entrenched. Let's take a look now at a fourth area of problems. Questionable interpretation and reporting. Questionable interpretation and reporting. Oh, surely not, you would say. Well, unfortunately so. Page 129 of this article, Palestine, Known but Mostly Unknown, in The Biblical Archaeologist, by Paul Lapp. He writes, the treatment of the sacred area at Shechem in the preliminary report is instructive on this point. The chief hypothesis is that the structure located under the fortress temple forecourt, which had previously been designated a palace, is to be interpreted as a courtyard temple, like examples found at Boghkoi in Anatolia. Now let me just draw this for you so that you can understand what was meant. There was a fortress temple found at Shechem, and then in front of it you had an open courtyard. Now under this courtyard, a structure was found underneath, in the layer underneath. Originally it was thought to be a palace. Now this excavator is writing, no, it's not a palace. It is a courtyard temple, and it is very, very similar to the Hittite temples in central Turkey. This is his hypothesis. Now, the hypothesis would seem to be dubious, since while the fortress temple itself, the structure on the top, lies completely exposed for all to see, the structure in this courtyard phase remains unexcavated, as is common. Notice his wording here. As is common, not as is sometimes the case. As is common in a preliminary report, the hypothesis seems to be set forth in the most favorable light. The parallels to the temples of the Hittites in central Turkey are considered remarkable, but the differences are not specified. Possible objections to the hypothesis, such as the fact that they found no cult objects or installations, and they did find domestic jar burials and ovens and other non-cultic structures, these are not considered. Would you say this man has done a very honest job? Not really. He started out with a presupposition. He saw in the evidence what he wanted to see and shoved everything that seemed to argue against it aside and doesn't even mention it. Now, how did Lapp know about these things? Because he talked to somebody who'd been part of the excavation staff. But how many people have that opportunity? Most people, even scholars, have to rely on what's written in the report. They have to rely that their colleague is giving them all the evidence and not just a portion of it. That's the problem. Then he goes on in his article and he says, the archaeologist is constantly tempted or forced to expand theories upon a small evidential base, which means a small amount of evidence. He builds his hypothesis on the small excavated portion of a building or on the tatters of a building disturbed by later occupation. He frequently uses arguments from silence. In other words, the fact that certain things are absent, even when he has excavated only a small fraction of the mound. For example, there's a man who believes that the general opinion as to where ancient Bethel and Ai are located, that the general consensus is wrong. And he's been digging at a new place, which he thinks might be the true site of biblical Ai. He dug there for 2 seasons. Did not find any remains from the Canaanite period at all. And immediately when his chief critic chortled in writing, you see, I always told you the place couldn't possibly be Ai. It was just uninhabited during the appropriate period. Well, he opened his mouth too soon, because the 3rd season brought to light evidence that it was occupied at the right period. In other words, the argument from silence, that there was no evidence to date from the appropriate period, did not prove it wasn't occupied then. They hadn't yet gotten to it. That's the problem, is archaeologists very often rely on the argument of silence. Or as he says, from surface finds. We're going to see when we study the Israelite conquest that Nelson Gluck, a very important and influential archaeologist, convinced the entire world of biblical archaeologists that Transjordan was totally uninhabited during the period when the Bible would place the Israelite arrival in Canaan. And therefore, there was no kingdom of Edom and Moab for the Israelites to have problems with. That biblical material is totally fictional because there are no settlements there. How did he know there were no settlements? Well, he had made a very thorough survey of the area. And in a survey, what you do is you drive by until you find a mound, then you walk over the mound, you pick up pieces of pottery on the surface, and that tells you what periods the site was occupied in. But the trouble with surface surveys is that they don't tell the whole story. As frequently, they do not indicate periods when they were occupied, because not all the pottery will show up on the surface. He never did a single excavation. It was simply on the basis of this surface survey that he came out with this grandiose conclusion, which everybody accepted uncritically, that the place was empty of settlement during the appropriate period. A conclusion that has now been shown to be false, based on actual excavations. But this is happening all the time. Now, why do such things happen? Why do scholars tend to present the evidence in the most favorable light? Why is it that they tend to shove aside data that seems to contradict what they want to be the case? Well, there are several reasons. One very important reason is they need to maintain the flow of money for their excavation. Unless they can show exciting things coming out of the earth, they'll lose their source of money. Now, I don't know how many of you have read the fictional work, The Source, by Michener. It describes a dig in Palestine. But in that account, it talks about how they have a very wealthy American industrialist who is the benefactor, who's providing the money for the dig. And he's coming over to take a look at, quote, his dig. And so they take a few things that they had found that look pretty nice. They rebury them so they can discover them just when he appears, you see. Maximum impact, you know, on him. To assure the flow of funds will continue. I mean, but the reason it's in the book, because it happens either not exactly that way, it happens similarly. Archaeologists feel forced to magnify their results to make sure the money keeps coming in. Equally important is they want to maintain the prestige of the dig. So they tend to over-dramatize what they found. Now, finally, we come to a 5th area of problems. And that is that interpretation, the key of the archaeological procedure, is a highly subjective process. I asked you to read the articles about Megiddo as to whether or not they were storehouses there or stables. Megiddo is, of course, a very important site in Palestine. Here is a model in this slide showing the city as they believe it existed at the time of King Ahab. They used to think this was the level of King Solomon. They know better. And they have the remains of these long, narrow buildings in several places on the site. Originally, they were declared to be the stables of Solomon, later corrected to the stables of Ahab. And now, of course, people claim it might not be stables at all, but storehouses. What did you learn from reading the article? What did you learn?
That it could go either way, just depending on the light that you presented
in. Yeah. That both sets of scholars, those that say they're definitely stables, and those that say they cannot be stables, they're definitely storehouses, they're all looking at the same evidence. But it depends on how you want to look at the evidence and how skillfully you present it, whether you carry your audience with you or not. And this is what I wanted you to see with your own eyes, is that if you read material in the future and you read a statement such as, and even in a secondary source, archaeologists have concluded that, ba 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 ba. And you say, uh-oh, that's terrible. That contradicts the Bible. What do I do about that? You have to remember that that doesn't mean that all archaeologists would conclude that. It's a very subjective thing in most cases. Now, there are some things that are not subjective. They're very clear. Like the case, again, we saw of that oven and the mosaic floor. Very clear which came first, which came second. That's not subjective. But much in the area of archaeological interpretation is highly subjective. Then we come to the matter of the Bama at Beersheba. Well, here's the case. Let me show you the slide of the building. This shows you those pillars that are mentioned in the article. And here are some of the mangers, if that's what they be. At Beersheba, the stones for this altar were found. Notice what I didn't say. What didn't I say? I didn't say this altar was found. I said the stones for this altar were found. Because you see, they were found all over. The altar had been disassembled and reused in other places. And then because of the workmanship, they were pretty sure they did go together into one special something. They took all the stones and worked with it, and sure enough, they easily came out with an altar. And then eventually it was clear when they found the top parts with the horns, they knew it had to be an altar. So there's no difficulty in reconstructing this, and nobody would doubt these stones originally had been part of the same altar, because they all fit together so well. The question was, where had this altar stood when it was being used? Now, Yadin had an interview, or rather Herschel Shanks interviewed Yadin, Yigael Yadin, who was one of the premier Israeli archaeologists. And Yadin, in this article that appeared in the Biblical Archaeology Review, entitled Yigael Yadin Finds a Bama at Beersheba, he expressed his opinion as to where it had appeared. What did you think of Yadin's arguments? Any reaction from someone who has not seen this material before? Brad?
It seemed pretty logical the way he laid it out. He said the stairs at a right angle would fit right there, and all the other evidence seemed pretty logical.
Yeah. He makes a very persuasive case. After this article appeared, and indeed it impressed me too, I admit to being very impressed by this argument, I thought, well, isn't that neat? They take biblical evidence and archaeological evidence and they put it together so beautifully and you get this conclusion, you know, of where this altar had stood. The next issue carried an article by Anson Rainey entitled No Bama at Beersheba. And the key quote from the article was, there is not one scrap of evidence, biblical or archaeology, to support Yadin's conclusions. What? Then what had Yadin been dealing with? Well, he had used a biblical verse, but admittedly the verse is ambiguous. The Bama mentioned in the verse could have been located in Jerusalem or in Beersheba. But Rainey showed that it seems much more likely to have been in Jerusalem. In that verse, it speaks about it being at the Joshua gate. He said, hey, Beersheba only had one gate. Why in the world would it have needed a name if there was only one? You don't have to distinguish it from others. Doesn't it seem unlikely it would have had a name? And then he showed other evidence that tore Yadin's theory to shreds. The most conclusive being that you notice in this photograph of the altar there's some stones missing that they hadn't found. You see in the back? Well, they found the missing stones. Not in this house with its nice little staircase with the right angle. Here's another close-up of that right angle. But under this rampart that leads into the city, the stones missing from the altar were found buried in here, under the rampart. But the problem is, this rampart was built at the same time that house with the peculiar staircase was built. Ergo, the altar had already been dismantled before the house with the staircase had ever been built. Therefore, it could never have stood there. Then there were a few other weaknesses. Remember that drainage channel to carry off all the gunk from the altar he talks about? Well, they found that the drainage channel didn't really originate near the altar. It originated in an inner room up close to the wall. And then it went out into the main street and then out, and it appears went into the well of the city. Much more likely, its purpose was to carry rainwater out and add it to the water supply of the city than it was to carry the gunk off from the altar. In fact, it actually ran right under the position of the altar, if the altar had ever been there. Very peculiar place for the drainage channel to run if it's supposed to carry things from off the altar. As I said, there were a number of things that were found later that just destroyed Yadin's theory totally. So you have to be careful. Just because an argument is persuasive doesn't mean it's right. The last article I asked you to read was entitled The Dual Problem of Archaeological Bias, Piety and Patriotism, Secularism and Skepticism. I think you got the point. That all archaeologists have a bias. And it goes to work when they investigate material. And it can either be pro-biblical or anti-biblical. The key thought that I'd like you to focus on in the article is in the next to last paragraph. Biblical archaeology's search for truth is more like a process than a proof, sometimes achieving tentative consensus, but seldom if ever achieving unquestionable knowledge. Data that is reviewed by one mind suggests an interpretation that is often different when reviewed by another. And he says, of course, piety, patriotism, ideology, training, and the opposite expression of these influence the archaeologist's judgment just as they do the historian's. And here's the real kicker. In candid moments, every professional archaeologist knows this. The best scholars know it about themselves. Others only know it about their colleagues. Okay, let you go.